This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Significant downtime.
It's a great honor to welcome back to this studio, live, right here on Rose Hill Drive, Richard Guy Wilson. He's an architectural historian at the University of Virginia and very familiar to any of us who've done any readings about the history of Mr. Jefferson's University. And Richard, here we are today talking about history being made at UVA and big changes underway. You know, the 40th anniversary of women being admitted as undergrads in the college, 40th anniversary, 40 years later, a woman is named as president. History is made again.
Yes, no, it's, well, as you say, change is what makes history. And indeed, it's very, very exciting that we're having this type of a change. John Castine has done a wonderful job, but time marches on.
Indeed. And speaking of change, that's one thing we want to talk about today. The changes at the university after Mr. Jefferson passed away and after the university opened for business in 1825. The last time you were with us before the holidays, we talked in some detail about the backstory, the founding of the university, and the designs and the plans, the vision that Mr. Jefferson had for the university. Today, let's carry that forward and talk about what happened at UVA after he passed away. And before we start, though, we should let folks know of an exhibit that is currently now on display at the University of Virginia. I was actually there this afternoon and really enjoyed it. Tell us where it is and what folks can see.
The title of the exhibit is From Village to Grounds, Architecture at the University After Jefferson or Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
And it's at the Special Collections or at the Harrison Small Special Collections Library, which is right next to Alderman. And it takes up basically the entire exhibition space there. It will be up until graduation or a hair after graduation. It's composed of original drawings and then reproductions of drawings and photographs that really tries to trace what happened to the academical village from 1826 until tomorrow. We have in buildings which are, well, South Lawn is just about to be completed and occupied, but we have in some other projects. And
yeah.
So we can't do every darn building,
right,
but we have a fair number of them in there.
Indeed. It's a beautiful exhibit, and I want to strongly encourage folks to check it out. You can park there at the University of Virginia parking garage right underneath the bookstore on Emmett Street, and it's a very short walk then to see this wonderful exhibit, which is free and open to the public. And it's From Village to Grounds, the University of Virginia After Thomas Jefferson. And we're honored to be talking with the curator of the exhibit, architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson. Richard, I like how you started this story right after the school opens. And shortly after Jefferson dies, just about a year after the school opens, they started noticing right away we got some problems, that Jefferson, had he lived, he wasn't done, that there were some limitations that the people recognized, the folks who had to live in his dream that came to life on the grounds there, they recognized that, well, he wasn't really done.
Yes, no, it's true. I mean, there were, of course, the construction took place from 1817, when it really broke ground, to Jefferson's death in 1826, when it was so-called pretty much done. But just in that time of 9 years, 10 years, already we're having weathering problems on buildings and so forth, and details weren't finished on the interiors. And when the professors came, they were rather upset at different times of what they found on the interiors. Some of Jefferson's ideas didn't work very well. He had a plan for academics, but he also had a plan for the way that the students would eat in the hotels. The hotel keepers, they were supposed to speak German and French, and you'd learn language there, but the hotel keepers discovered that what they really could do was that they could sell a little hooch to the students, and that was a lot more exciting. So.
Good fun. And one of the severest limitations that was faced in those first few decades was classroom space. Yes. And tell us about that and the solution they found to that in the building on, literally building on to the academical village.
Well, one of the things that Jefferson couldn't foresee, several things he couldn't foresee, one thing was just simply change in education and methods of education over time. And he had conceived it as this rather small, intimate type of thing, but you have the growth of what are called large lectures. And so there was this huge annex put onto the rotunda that stretched to the north that provided a huge public hall because they needed a public hall. Jefferson considered that the library, the dome of the rotunda, would be the public hall, but that just simply, and there was another problem. He saw, came up with a list of 8,500 books. Fine, but, he couldn't foresee that right at the same time as happening, you're having huge changes in the printing industry, cheaper paper, and books that were a relatively scarce, high-priced commodity. All of a sudden, the price drops, and all of a sudden, you have books, and
so a lot more books in that library than he ever could have dreamed of.
Never could have dreamed of. How could he have? Again, this is how do you look to the future on these things? So he had the problem of the library and space there, and then you had the problem that you needed new classroom space. And so this huge annex was put on. It was designed by Robert Mills. Robert Mills was a very preeminent American architect, born in Charleston, South Carolina in 1781. He used to like to claim that he was the first American architect because he was actually born, i.e., after the Revolution. And he actually had studied with Jefferson for about 5 months. In 1803, he used Jefferson's library and did drawings, and there are some drawings of his for Monticello. And then he went on to a very illuminous career. He designed the Washington Monument in D.C., the U.S. Department of Treasury, the old Patent Office building, a lot of buildings. I mean, he was really a major, major American figure. And I suspect that the Board of Visitors chose him because he had this Jefferson connection. And so he did do this big annex with new materials such as cast iron columns, and you still see some of the fragments of those cast iron columns scattered around the grounds and so forth in different places. Put this big thing on, but it was really, well, anyway, it was not that good looking, let's put it that way. And so when the fire happened—
And for folks who don't know, it went on the north face of the rotunda out to University Avenue.
Yes, a huge long thing, a huge tail to the building. That sort of overwhelmed, that one might say, though actually it was liked well at the time. But by the 1890s, when the fire broke out that burned down the rotunda, it was not that well liked. And I've never been able to find any issues or anybody claiming that they wanted to rebuild the rotunda.
Rebuild the annex.
The
We're
annex.
Talking with architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson of the University of Virginia, the curator of an exhibit now on display at UVA, From Village to Grounds, the University of Virginia after Thomas Jefferson. And we're talking about some of the more well-known aspects of that history and the changes that took place after Mr. Jefferson passed away. So the annex goes on to the rotunda in the 1850s at a time when the school was booming. The population was up. The railroad had come to Charlottesville. It's a lot easier to get there. A lot more kids are coming, and they want to go to school here. They need classroom space. They need more room for the libraries. And so they build this massive building onto the front, or what was the back of the rotunda.
Right.
And Robert Mills, of course, studied with Jefferson. So the look and feel of the annex sort of fit with the academical village.
Sort of. But it was, say, the scale was overdone on it, I think. One of the interesting things was inside in the public hall, there was a big copy put up of Raphael's School of Athens mural. Now, we have today the School of Athens mural down in Old Cabell Hall, but it actually appears here initially, a copy, not the same copy, appears here in the 1850s.
Very famous painting of the...
In the Vatican, one of the great paintings of the Italian Renaissance, where you have brought together all of the great thinkers of the ancient world are all gathered together. You have Socrates and Aristotle walking down, one pointing up, the other pointing down. In other words, where's reality? Is it up there or is it down here?
Yeah, type of thing. That's great. Right. And of course, there was a public talk in that room one evening in the fall of 1895, and then the next morning, a Sunday morning, the bell started to ring in the rotunda, and the cry of fire went out.
Right.
The fire started in the attic of the annex.
Yes. Yes. Apparently, a fire broke out in an electrical system, and it spread in the annex. A university professor and students, they actually tried to dynamite the connection between the annex and the rotunda and the library, but that didn't work, and the fire jumped over to the rotunda. Students rushed inside, pulled out the statue of Jefferson, and saved several thousand books, but an awful lot of stuff went up in flames.
Yeah. And the annex and the rotunda itself were completely gutted,
right,
were they not?
Right.
It was just totally destroyed.
Yes, totally destroyed. Totally destroyed.
Yeah. So that to this day, when you look at the rotunda, really the only thing original to Jefferson that was there when he was here were perhaps the exterior brick walls, is that?
A portion of the lower exterior brick walls are original, and there are on the inside because, well, we're getting into a long story here of messing around with the rotunda. There is in one of the lower oval rooms, they uncovered what looks like ovens that maybe was used for a chemistry lab in Jefferson's time or something like that. But no, basically the building we see there today in many, many ways resembles Jefferson, especially from the lawn side, from the south side, resembles Jefferson. The north side is not anything like him because one of the problems there was with Jefferson's scheme for the university was that he saw that everybody would go down to the south end of the lawn and come in and progress up it towards the rotunda. And while the old Lynchburg Road, or JPA, ran down there, still an awful lot of your traffic was on University Avenue because that was the major east-west road. And were you going to go a quarter of a mile out of your way to get in when you could get in other ways? And so the entry never worked well. And so one of the things that the firm that was selected to do the architecture and the man who's best known of it, the name of the firm is McKim, Mead & White, and Stanford White was the architect. And we can talk about Stanford White in a minute here.
Yeah, yeah.
But they put on a new north entrance to it. And so that the new idea was that you would come up the north side, up the steps, into the rotunda, into this huge space, and then from there exit out onto the lawn down stretching out.
Which I like. Yeah. I sort of like that. It's a very majestic way to enter, as is, you know, if you did find your way to the foot of lawn, it's a majestic way as well to enter there at the foot of the lawn. We're talking with Richard Guy Wilson of the University of Virginia. I got ahead of myself, though. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that throughout the 19th century, Jefferson was not really well known as the architect of the university, was known as the founder, but it wasn't really well known that he had actually designed these buildings.
That's true. Jefferson's reputation as an architect is pretty much a 20th century creation, and indeed it's been contentious in the 20th century about it. Here locally, it was, yes, known that he probably had something to do with the university. Yes, Monticello was his. But other than that he did much of anything else was really unknown. Now, let me just say that this is not unusual because in general, Americans had a pretty big inferiority complex regarding their culture and their architecture in the 19th century and very little interest in what went before. Yes, Washington's Mount Vernon was saved. But in general, it's in the latter 19th century when you begin to get developing an interest in colonial architecture, the founding fathers type of thing, and the beginning of what we call historic preservation movement and saving buildings. And it is then that Jefferson begins to come in focus. As I say, there are articles still being written. Well, he really didn't do this, you understand, and so forth, in spite of you can show him drawings. Well, anyway, there's as you know, there's always aliens out there.
But Jefferson was sort of rediscovered in the latter part of the 1800s and in the first part of the 20th century.
The reason why he was really rediscovered is the fire. The fire, which, and this comes back around to the big event of today, the fire that burned down the rotunda and the rebuilding of it, the architects who wound up doing it, the New York firm of McKim, Mead, and White, were the preeminent firm in the country. There was nobody that was higher than them, and they very much wanted it because Charlie McKim, the senior partner, had come down here in 1891 and said, I don't believe that we have something like this in this country. Because, after all, Charlottesville is a rural, out-of-the-way place and so forth. And so when the fire happened, they really went campaigning, and they did get the job. And that really brought, because the such eminent architects were willing to work on something, you know, isolated, out of the way, really brought attention onto it. And so they are one of the reasons for it. The other thing, though, that the fire is very important was that it was such a battle getting the work done because, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, Jefferson didn't believe in much government. You have the faculty, they sort of met. Boy, faculty meetings. then you had the Board of Visitors, you know, and there wasn't anything in between. And so this reconstruction was just overwhelming to the university. And it is because of the overwhelming and the mess that it was, the absolute mess of this, that they didn't have any way of managing it down here to do it, that the Board of Visitors decided, well, we've got to get a president. And so in 1904, Alderman was brought on board.
A direct result, again, of the fire.
A direct result of the fire and the realization that a lot of other universities began, the idea of the strong chief executive begins in the 1870s. Harvard, always Harvard is a leader, University of Michigan with Angel there, you begin to get these strong chief executives. The other thing that was happening in these years is new methods of education, and the German system of higher education begins to really make inroads in this country. Because up to that point in time, let's say up to the Civil War, when you went to college, you basically all studied exactly the same darn thing for the first year, the second year, the third year, the fourth year. Everybody took the same classes. The idea of specialization and this sort of thing was just not around. And the Germans come up with this, and also the idea of the advanced degrees, the master and the PhD. That's really a German importation over here, 1870s, 1880s. And what is fascinating is that Jefferson actually, his original academic model was this idea of specialization, but he dies, and the university reverts to the standard model. But it is in the 1880s, it's all of a sudden rediscovered. Gosh, Jefferson, he actually had this idea back there, though it was never really implemented.
Fascinating. We're going to continue this conversation with architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson after a break for local news and weather. Stay with us. This is Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070, WINA. Let's rejoin our conversation with architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson of the University of Virginia. We're talking about an exhibit that he curated. It's currently being shown at the University of Virginia. It's free. It's open to the public and located in, was that Peabody Hall? Collections.
Special Collections. Harrison Small or...
Right. The Harrison Small Library right there next to Alderman, right in front of Alderman. And you walk right in the front door and go to your right. And again, this is free, open to the public. It's a beautiful exhibit with archival photographs, drawings, maps of how the university has changed since Mr. Jefferson passed away in 1826. Richard, let's talk a little bit about some of the buildings that went up in the 19th century. And they're very, very different from the academical village. And we're thinking of the chapel and especially Brooks Hall, which just really sticks out, and what's now Varsity Hall, the first infirmary. Tell us about how these things happened and how the thinking then was very, very different about what would be built and what it would look like on grounds.
Well, I think that one reason why things were different is simply change, that there's changes of taste, and it's inevitable. Time passes, and, well, we're not going to have history if we don't have time passing. But the second thing was that there really wasn't any idea that the academical village, Jefferson's design, was that neat, that wonderful. People had to live with it. There were problems with it. They needed changes, and so you get this. One of the areas that was a humongous battle through the 19th century was the whole issue of religion at the university. Jefferson, of course, we were not religiously controlled, which was every other institution of higher learning in this country was basically had a religious control on it, whether you're going to the Congregationalists at Harvard or the Presbyterians at Princeton. The University of North Carolina, which predates us as a state institution, where is it located?
Chapel Hill.
Chapel Hill, and it's Presbyterian there. Now, I mean, these separations have occurred since then, but at the time, the religion was a very central issue. And that Jefferson didn't have, though he did, and let me just say, there were religious services held while he was alive in the rotunda, while he was alive. He didn't preclude that. And he also saw that if, say, the Baptists or the Episcopalians wanted to have an institution, they would create one here in Charlottesville, that this might be like a Cambridge or an Oxford in England. But that model of separate colleges has never been the American model, with one or two minor exceptions. But anyway, not having a religion here meant that we're training a bunch of heathens up here in Charlottesville. And so there's a constant battle. And as early as 1831, there is a proposal for putting a chapel on the lawn. Now, we don't have any drawings of it. We just know that it occurs in writings. By 1859, there is a drawing done, which we have in the exhibition, of a Gothic Revival chapel that was to be put right at the end of the lawn between pavilions 9 and 10. And it would be Gothic Revival, pointy arches, crenellations, all of this.
Like Duke University or something.
It would be the exact opposite. And what happened, of course, this was a fundraising thing, and a couple of events would happen in the next couple of years that preclude much of anything happening here at the university for a number of years. But as I say, religion is a really strong, well, it still is today in American life, a really strong and contentious element, and is a very strong thing here. Finally, in the 1880s, a group of women, certainly with some money coming from their husbands, did collect together a pile of money, and a chapel was built. Thank goodness, and it's a wonderful building, but thank goodness it's not right on the lawn. Rather than that, it is to the northwest side of the rotunda in the Gothic Revival style. The architect of it was actually a graduate of the university in engineering by the name of Charles Cassell. We had no architecture school here, let me just note, until 1919. He was an engineer, was from Norfolk, as I recall, was in the Confederate cavalry, does set up an office up in Baltimore and becomes an architect, and he designs the chapel. And if you've never been in the chapel, you ought to, because there's a wonderful set of stained glass windows in there.
It's a beautiful building.
Yeah, beautiful building.
And it's very, it's not ostentatious, it's not huge, it's very, you know, sort of muted and understated.
Yes, though, it's interesting, at the dedication of it, or the laying of the cornerstone, one of the speakers was a professor of language, Maximilian de Vere. And Mr. de Vere, and I'm paraphrasing, in his talk says, "Behind us rises the dome of paganism. In front of us rises the arch of Christianity." Now, I know that many listeners or people won't get that, don't see things quite that way today. But that shows just, I think, how strong this type of association was, and that buildings do have meanings, that there are meanings that are implied in buildings, or you read things into them.
So there were certainly those in Virginia at the time, indeed in the country, who saw that rotunda as a symbol of paganism, anti-religion, specifically anti-Christianity.
Yes. Now, if I can add a footnote to this, one of the most interesting events I ever had in my life is now about 12 years ago. I and a couple of friends went down to church one Sunday to Jerry Falwell in Lynchburg. And it happened to be the Sunday that he was coming back from trying to save that ministry in North Carolina, Tammy Faye and the Baker thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he came home And I'm back, and I'm back, and we're going to do well here. And you know what we're going to do? We're going to build a new church, a new Liberty Church, and it's going to be modeled on the University of Virginia's rotunda, except it's going to be twice as big. And as I'm saying, it shows you how your meanings do change on things.
Indeed. Architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson is our guest this afternoon, talking about the changes at the University of Virginia after Jefferson's death in 1826. That's the chapel in about 1885. Of course, about 10 years before that, just a few hundred yards away, there's a building called Brooks Hall,
yes,
which everyone who comes to Charlottesville looks at it and says, now what in the world is that building doing here on the grounds of Mr. Jefferson's University? And there's a joke among students, some of whom who actually believe this, that, oh, that those designs were meant for another school and it accidentally got built here.
Yes, no, that's the standard story. Or sometimes the chapel gets that story. It depends on who wants to have it. The story on Brooks Hall is that Mr. Brooks was a philanthropist from Rochester, New York, who had a significant amount of money. And he gave collections of taxidermy and natural history collections to a couple of southern universities because he felt that somehow he had to get the South back into the Union. And so he made the offer here to the university that I'm going to give you some stuffed animals and some geological specimens. And the university said, well, thank you, but we don't have any place to put it. And so in any event, he did give a check for, I think it was about $10,000, and a set of designs. And the designs, it was a man by the name of John R. Thomas. And Mr. Thomas was also an architect up in Rochester, New York. And the designs came down. And, of course, if you look at the building, you can see all those heads and the names and so forth around there. And that's what it was. This was the Museum of Natural History. On the inside, there was this huge two-story central space in which there was a mastodon. The stuffed mastodon was in there, along with other elements. And Thomas, the architect of John R. Thomas, did go on to a very illustrious career. He's not much remembered today, except perhaps here. But he did design a building at Cornell, some stuff in New York City. And that's where the story gets that, well, the Cornell building was meant for here and
okay,
up there, but in reality, there's no truth to that. The drawings we have in the exhibit, they're all University of Virginia and very clear. Now, the fascinating thing about it is, let me just say, that the orientation of it, the front door faces towards West Main Street, because that had become West Main Street as you came out of downtown. That was your major entrance into the university, was along the so-called long walk that's led up there. And so this was really a reorientation of the university towards trying to make a connection to the town.
Yeah, which we're talking with Richard Guy Wilson, which after the fire in 1895, when Stanford White went to work, he reoriented, as you were telling us yeah, earlier, he sort of added to that right, conversation and yeah, reoriented the front door of the rotunda would then be on the university side right, instead of on the lawn side right, as Jefferson had intended.
Yes, right. No, and that's one of the things is, again, one of the problems of the Jefferson's idea was that his way that you would enter the university just never worked very well.
Yeah. Tell us about Stanford White and has a dramatic impact on the University of Virginia after the fire. And you can really look at the history of the of UVA if you want to, yeah, before the fire and after the fire, because it's a very different place.
Yes. Well, Stanford White was a member of the New York firm of McKim, Mead, and White, which were the preeminent architects in the country at the turn of the last century, doing buildings all over the country, though they're primarily New York, but the Boston Public Library is their building, which sets the model for American libraries for the next 45, 50 years. Lots and lots of things. Stanford White has, though, another reputation other than being an architect, because he was a man about town with some of the ladies, and he had an affair with a chorus girl by the name of Evelyn Nesbitt. And Miss Nesbitt was subsequently did snare a millionaire by the name of Harry K. Thaw, and they got married. And then somehow Thaw discovered, or Evelyn told him something about her prior affair with Stanford White. And so on a June night in 1906, on the roof garden of the old Madison Square Garden, I say the old Madison Square Garden, not the awful thing today they call Madison Square Garden, which isn't even at Madison Square, a building which Stanford White had worked on in the firm of McKim, Mead & White, on an evening in June 1906, Harry K. Thaw, they were up there watching a musical, and Harry K. Thaw came up and wham, 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 take that, you cad, and murdered Stanford White. The ensuing trial, well, this is the time of the Yellow Paper Wars, of the Hearst and the Pulitzers, and, well, it's, you know, nothing much has changed on this, and trying to dig up all the dirt that you possibly could, and it was just a big thing. So there's been an endless number of movies, novels. E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime was done on it. The movie there, Norman Mailer plays the part of Stanford White in that. And an earlier movie, it's Farley Granger plays the part of Stanford White. And
He a celebrity in his own in his own era?
Yes, I mean, yeah, he was a celebrity, certainly. He was a brilliant architect. He's a brilliant architect. But he was also one of these guys who, well, we have them all the time.
Yeah.
Their private lives sometimes get in the way of their public life.
Yeah. Now, his work here at the University of Virginia remodeled the rotunda after the fire.
Well, rebuilt the rotunda
and
changed the interior of the rotunda, was changed considerably. It was one huge two-story tall space, and he did not rebuild on the interior the way that Jefferson did it because they needed more space for the library. Now, we subsequently re-restored the rotunda in 1970s. And put back in the Jefferson sort of interior there. Then he also did the buildings at the end of the lawn, Cabell, or now today Old Cabell, and Cock and Ross Hall. And then later on, the firm came back and did Garrett Hall and Cars Hill. And so, yes, his impact was tremendous.
Now, what are your thoughts when Stanford White made the argument, well, if Jefferson was alive today, this is what he would have done with his rotunda. He wouldn't have, you know, now with, you know, almost 100 years later, we can do things engineering-wise that he couldn't have dreamed of, and we can have this interior space, and he would have done this if he could. So let's do this. Let's change it.
Well, that's, of course, what's the problem of any of us historians? You study a person closely enough and so forth, you think, well, I know exactly what it is that they would think then. In one level, I do think that Stanford White wasn't all that totally wrong. Jefferson was totally fascinated with engineering, with modern technology, with advanced technology. And, of course, the dome on Jefferson's rotunda was a wood truss dome, a laminated wood truss dome. And you get a fire, and that's the end of that. This was a French system that had been invented in the 16th century in France and was used on many of the domes of in American buildings. By the time that Stanford White is along, there's a new system in place called the Guastavino Vault, and that's what we actually have up there, which is a very thin, highly fired tile type of a vault that covers gigantic spaces, and B is totally fireproof. And the Guastavinos, they came from Barcelona in Spain, brought this system over here in the 1870s. And up until the Depression, really, almost every large indoor space in any major American building is probably using Guastavino vault or a takeoff on it. Now, of course, what happens is there's new systems now of different types of things. But this was the system that was used. It was intended to be used down at Cabell Hall or Old Cabell Hall, though typically the university ran out of money for the dome. And so the dome up there is not in the hall when you're sitting there. But if you go down underneath to the music library, you can see the Guastavino vault down there, and it's a beautiful system.
Richard Guy Wilson, he's an architectural historian at the University of Virginia and the curator of an exhibit now on display at the Harrison Institute and Small Library on grounds at the University of Virginia, right there next to Alderman Library. This exhibit is free, it's open to the public, and it explores the changes and development of the University of Virginia in design and architecture after Mr. Jefferson. And Richard, what I'd like to do is get you back for another conversation, and we'll sort of pick up where we've left off and look closely at the modern movement at the University of Virginia throughout the 20th century and some of the buildings that were built after McKim, Mead, and White got done here, and sort of phasing into what you have called now this neoclassical movement, and into things like John Paul Jones Arena, which I think is just a big brick box with a colonnade stuck on the front of it, but still an effort on the part of architects to speak to the academical village and to join that long conversation. That keeps changing. It's very fascinating. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.